the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
I think this might be our first new book of the year, and this is one which is of great interest to me personally. It's called Off the Scales, the inside story of Ozempic and the race to cure obesity. Aimee Donlan, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm very interested personally because, as I've said on the programme before, I'm a type 2 diabetic and I've been using Ozempic for, I think, 6 years at this stage. I was one of the very early adapters. But I think lots of people are using it now, aren't they? And not necessarily just the people with type 2 diabetes for whom it was originally prescribed.
Yes, I think that would be very fair to say. Because obviously there is, as we know, a very important side effect with Ozempic, which is weight loss. So it started off, like yourself, type 2 diabetics needed to take it. And now it is appearing to be used as a weight loss drug as well. So people who are living with obesity can also take Ozempic. And that's what we're seeing. So when there were shortages, for example, in America, if you couldn't get your hands on Wegovy, which is the obesity medication, Ozempic worked, but it's obviously a lower dose. So, yeah.
Tell us all about, you've got a fascinating study of how Ozempic came about. Tell me, first of all, about, I think, somebody from Europe who was working in America, Slovakian, is it?
So she's from the former Yugoslavia. Her name is Svetlana Moisov, and she goes over to America in the 1970s. She watched the moon landing, and she is very inspired by like scientific development. She's young. She's just finished a degree. And she is told by one of her professors that New York, and specifically Rockefeller University, is the place to go if you want to make a mark in science. So she heads off to do her PhD, and she quickly becomes really interested in hormones. So this is like what governs our body, basically what controls your blood sugar. So she starts working on glucagon, which is one of many powerful hormones which impacts blood sugar. And she makes a breakthrough, and then she heads off to Mass General, which is one of the top research institutions in the world. It's based in Boston. And there she is among like the top scientists who are dealing with hormones, and one specific scientist who has identified a little known hormone called GLP-1. And this is the secret sauce in Ozempic, Mounjaro, all of these different drugs.
Why is it so?
So at the time, this was all hypothetical and theoretical. They didn't really know whether this thing existed, what it did in the body. So once she basically identifies it, manages to make it synthetically in her lab, they can start testing it, and they can see that it is the most incredible hormone, because what it does to blood sugar is it works like a thermostat. It brings blood sugar down to just the right level and then switches off when it gets to that level. And that is something that insulin does not do. So insulin, if you are a type 1 diabetic and you are relying on insulin really to live, insulin is like a jackhammer. It will bring down your blood sugar very, very quickly. And if the dose is wrong by a fraction, you could end up in a very, very dire state and maybe even go into a coma. So they were really keen to try and find new ways of treating diabetes that were much more careful. And this appeared to be it.
But this is back when, the 1970s or 1980s?
So we're now in the 80s. So we're around like 86 is when she teams up with this Joel Habner, which is this top scientist in Mass General. And she's cooking up the GLP-1, and he is helping her test it, write research papers that ultimately go like all over the world. And then they are also working against the University of Copenhagen, which is also trying to make breakthroughs in the very same thing. So there's this kind of like, think Russia, US, you know, the moon race. It's a sort of similar situation in that they're both trying to prove the powers of GLP-1.
But let's jump on, because that's 30 years before we actually have a product that people started to use.
Absolutely. So this would not be uncommon, I don't think, in pharmaceuticals, because this is sort of proof of concept. That's what they're doing in the lab. And then once they have proved that, and as I said, all of these research papers were peer reviewed and everyone established that GLP-1 existed, you then move on to Novo Nordisk, which is in Denmark. And this is the company at the time, in the 90s we're in now, this is the biggest insulin maker in the world. So they are the powerhouse of diabetes. And so they take the licensing rights from Mass General for GLP-1. And two scientists start working on a drug that they think can work on diabetes. But from the very beginning, they meet unbelievable resistance within the company for this project.
Why?
Again, it still was fairly theoretical that this could actually work as a drug. What happens to GLP-1, the version that they were working with, is that your body flushes it out almost immediately. So it's injected into your bloodstream and your kidneys flush it out. So they identify it, they get rid of it, and it's gone. So it can't do what it needs to do to your blood sugar. So they spend a lot of time with chemists and they come up with a kind of cloaking device for GLP-1, which protects it and allows it to do what it needs to do in your body, which is to bring down your blood sugar. It also impacts the brain and it has this very obvious side effect, which is weight loss. And this isn't that unusual for drugs.
There's you keep describing it as a side effect. I would have thought that for many people, it's the actual rationale for the drug.
Well, definitely at the time, that was not the thinking. So yes, obviously, in today's world, in the US, where 70% of people are either overweight or living with obesity, it would obviously seem like the most obvious thing in the world that this would be the drug. But in the 90s, early 90s, obesity was not where it is today. And at the time as well, they're in Denmark. And I don't know if you've ever been to Denmark, but for your listeners who have, it is a very healthy society. A lot of personal responsibility, social democracy. And so the way that they view weight and excess weight and obesity is that it is very much lifestyle, that you are making poor choices, and that the executives that they talk to are saying, why on earth are we looking at obesity? Why would we be trying to create a weight loss drug here?
That's very interesting, because I think that's deeply unfair to people who struggle with their weight, who often make all sorts of efforts and still find that they cannot actually control their weight. Look, I'm making excuses for myself and for the reason why I think I became type 2 diabetic, and the treatment that I've had to have involving this drug is because no matter what I tried to do, I just kept putting the weight on and kept having that sweet tooth.
Yes. And I think that certainly from talking to the people that I spoke to who are on these drugs, that is very much what they experienced, that weight for them really began in early childhood. That was when they started to notice that their parents were noticing it, and they were brought to doctors and dietitians. And it seemed to me that what I really noticed was around the age of 7, this is when people start to realize that they're in bigger bodies and that being in a bigger body in our society is not okay. So they're not unhealthy. They're not obese at this level. They just are in a bigger body and this needs to be tackled somehow. This is what they're kind of the message that they're being given. But then as they get older and the weight does become a health issue, they're going to doctors very regularly. And to your point about, I agree with you, this is nothing to do with self-control. These people are losing 50 pounds sometimes at a time. And I often say to people, like, imagine losing 50 pounds. Imagine the willpower you'd have to lose 50 pounds. So the idea that these people don't have willpower is...
Well, I'll give you another example. As a friend of mine puts it, who I go weight training with and was doing this long before I ever went on the drug, as he said, if you lose 20 kilos, just think of the effort it takes to carry a 20 kilo dumbbell. Yeah. And that's what you've actually taken off your body.
Yes, absolutely. And what then happens to these people, and I don't know if this was your experience, but what happened to Sarah, who opens the book, is that she is so defeated by one last diet that she goes to a nurse practitioner. Now, she has already moved away from a doctor because she can't bear the idea of being put on the scales again, lectured about her weight and told to go to Weight Watchers again. But this nurse practitioner says, you know something, you don't have to go on another diet. There's this drug and they've just approved it. It's 2021. This is Wegovy. Why don't you try that? And she said she doesn't think about the side effects. She doesn't think about what this will do to her body. She lifts up her shirt and lets this woman inject her. And I think that shows the sort of desperation of this, that, you know, I don't think I would take a drug without thinking about
it. But what's also interesting, which you go into the book, is this woman's experience, which I think might be for many people, is that other people started treating her differently because she was thinner.
Yes, absolutely. So she loses about 75 pounds. And during that journey, her long-term boyfriend proposes to her. She gets a big promotion at work, big pay rise. And she notices everywhere she goes that people are engaging with her, touching her arm warmly as they speak to her. Her father is much more attentive. He's listening more to her when she tells stories, the same stories she was already telling him. But now she's got kind of a captive audience. And for her, she kind of describes it as, you know, obviously it's lovely that people are more engaging, but it's also very depressing because it means that without weight, she's valued. And with it, she's sort of, as it's called in the book, like kind of invisible.
There's so much in the book, we're only going to be bouncing around various things rather than taking this linear through the book. But I am actually very interested in the description of GLP-1 drugs as making people feel fuller for longer. I'm not sure I necessarily find that as my own personal experience, but it's more that I don't actually have the desire to eat certain foods or drink alcohol. It's not necessarily that I'm feeling full, but the idea of having certain foodstuffs just isn't appealing. And if I have a certain amount of, okay, maybe this is a feeling fuller thing, but one glass of wine, and that might be, I can't even finish a pint.
Really?
Yeah.
So I think...
See, and some people, the way you say really, there is like, God, sympathetic towards me, you know, is this what it does to you?
I'm not really a pint girl, but yes, I think if I had no appetite for margaritas, I might be devastated. I think they talk about satiety. So this is, I think actually what you're describing is sort of what I think scientists and the pharmaceutical industry would love to hear, because the idea that you aren't craving food is really what they want, rather than you feel full. Because some people who go on the drug sort of say that they feel like that feeling after you have a Christmas dinner and then somebody puts a steak in front of you, that you're kind of repulsed by food. Yeah. And I watched that Catherine Thomas documentary where, you know, this woman talks about sitting across the table and there's like a bowl of broccoli and she's like feels like she's almost going to be sick looking at the broccoli. And I thought, that's not what you want. That's not where you want to be. And even from like a social faux pas kind of situation, you don't want to be at a dinner where the person opposite you doesn't want to eat. Like that has an impact, I think, on your social life too.
No, there's all sorts of other things that have been suggested that GLP-1s can actually, if you use them, can other behaviours can be affected, such as gambling.
Yes, yeah. And this is a big problem for gambling companies because there's all this...
Pity about them.
there's all this research to suggest that actually it's a very small proportion of gamblers who make up the largest profits of these companies. So these are like super gamblers.
Yeah.
So if they also are the people who go on these drugs, that means a lot less revenue for these companies. So that is significant. I don't know how much research there is. There's certainly anecdotal evidence that people aren't interested in gambling, that they stop smoking. They're not, as you said, whether they're interested in alcohol or whether they just don't have an appetite for it. A man I spoke to talked about he had this kind of voracious appetite for Diet Coke. He used to drink like gallons of Diet Coke every week. And then he goes on these drugs and looks in his fridge and is like, that bottle has been there for weeks. So I think there's a lot of those kind of things because it does impact the dopamine center of your brain. And I interviewed actually Donal O'Shea, the obesity expert in Ireland for the book. And he talked about a man who he was treating for obesity because he was in a facility, a very high-tech facility for violent offenders. And this man had not offended. He had not basically had a violent outburst in 6 months on these drugs. So that's even, I mean, I think fascinating. That's obviously one example, but I think it's interesting.
Of course, if you say it's bad for the gambling firms, it might be very bad for an awful lot of food processors and producers and alcohol companies and other drink companies. Things with sugar, which have been added, which essentially since maybe the turn of the 20th century have addicted people to their products. As the tolerance for that sugar goes, what happens to those businesses?
So I think this is a real moment for those businesses. I think that they became very large, I think, because of this. There was this need for convenience and for longevity of food. And that had many different causes to it. But the fact is, and I don't know if this is your experience, but a lot of people I've spoken to say that they crave healthy foods, that they are really put off by sugar, that they don't really like fat. One woman I spoke to said that she was trying to save for a house, so she was really monitoring her takeout habit. And that went down to zero on these drugs. So all of those things are problematic for the food industry because they can't sell you a piece of salmon. They can't sell you, McDonald's has tried a salad. It just doesn't work in their model. So what I would imagine they're going to try and do is in the short term, they will focus on the poorer customers, people who cannot afford these drugs. So they will very aggressively market to them. And in the longer term, I would imagine when that doesn't work and maybe these drugs are more widespread, I think they'll be trying to adapt their food to to make it that little bit more palatable to you to try and get you to think that it's healthier.
Okay, you mentioned weight loss as being a side effect.
Yes.
But if we say that's the core reason...
Let's talk about the core reason.
Yeah, but what about other side effects? Has there been sufficient research done into the use of these drugs as to potential side effects? Now, I know there are positive things, and that one of the reasons it was sold to me was that it reduces the likelihood of heart attack or stroke, mm-hmm. which... when you're a type 2 diabetic, you have a much elevated risk of those things, and this actually brings them down. And that's great, but are there other things that could actually happen as a result of using these drugs long term? Are we only learning that as we sort of go through this real life experiment with them?
We are definitely in a real life experiment, I would say that, because obviously these drugs have never been taken in the quantities that we are seeing now today. But the first GLP-1 drug was approved in 2004 in the US. And that was this, you know, the Gila monster. So it wasn't the version that we're dealing with now. The earliest version of the type that are today was 2010. So that's 16 years of fairly widespread use for diabetics and people living with obesity. And they have been used by humans in clinical trials since the 90s. So that's how much evidence we have in terms of like whether they would cause cancers and things like that. In the earliest clinical trials, there was a thyroid issue in terms of that rats and mice developed thyroid tumors while taking these drugs. And the FDA in America, the Food and Drug Administration, which is the healthcare regulator, demanded that Novo Nordisk provide reams of evidence to prove that these did not cause the same issues in humans, which they did, and it took them a very long time to gather all of that evidence. So, but if you go on to any of these sites today and you type in that you want to get Ozempic, thyroid issues will come up. Do you have any thyroid issues? Is there any history of thyroid cancer in your family? That will be a question that you will be asked. So that would be one executive referred to that as a black box, the thyroid issue. I don't know whether that's going to be an issue in the long term. Some people talk about sight issues and again, I think this is to do with blood sugar, that people are sort of...
Yeah, but type 2 diabetes interferes with your eyesight anyway.
It does. There is a very small minority of people who are developing gastroparesia, which is basically where your stomach stops working. There is pancreatitis. There's another thing that's linked to these drugs. All of these things are bad, very bad. And I think that what people are doing is they're weighing up those side effects, which include all the gastric stuff that I'm sure listeners know about a little bit.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose that's what's interesting to me. For example, maybe I'm oversharing here, but anyway, I had to have my gallbladder taken out to allow me to be able to actually use this and other medications involved in my type 2 diabetes because there were gallstones and the rest of it. But this is monitored. I wonder about these people who have decided on using it as a lifestyle drug, who might not necessarily have had a doctor's suggestion for this, who are simply taking it because it means that they look lighter.
I think this is probably the most, I think most important probably thing that we need to discuss, which is that you're absolutely right, that people like you who are prescribed these medications, you will be very closely monitored. You'll be given the lowest dose to begin with. It'll be then ratcheted up as you...
That's what happened with me, yes.
Yeah, so as you tolerate it. So if you begin at the very beginning in the lowest dose and your body's not tolerating that well, you're vomiting, you have diarrhea, you have other gastric issues, your doctor more than likely will say, let's stick with the low dose and keep you there until we think you're ready to go up to the highest dose. What I have heard from people who are taking these drugs for a vanity perspective, go to the highest dose straight away because they want the maximum weight loss. And I think that's really dangerous. And I think that you'll see more and more people going to A&E if that's how people are using them.
It's called Off the Scales, the inside story of Ozempic and the race to cure obesity. There's lots more we can talk about, but I think we've whetted the appetite of listeners with that. Amy Donlan, thank you so much for joining us.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.